Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Ian Lipkin, who's the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, who has over 30 years of experience in microbial discovery and outbreak response. In the 1980s, Dr. Lipkin identified AIDS-associated immunological abnormalities and was the first to use purely molecular methods to identify infectious agents and implicated West Nile virus as the cause of the encephalitis epidemic in New York in 1999. He assisted the World Health Organization and the People's Republic of China during the 2003 SARS outbreak, and his team have discovered or characterized more than 500 infectious agents. He is now working with an international team of scientists to investigate the deadly new coronavirus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ian Lipkin.
Thanks for the invitation.
And MERS is a mystery, right? Scientists do not know where it came from. It's already infected at least 77 people and killed 40 in eight countries, but it seems to be mostly centered in Saudi Arabia. Is that correct?
All of what you said is correct. We don't know the origins of the virus, but by sequencing the virus, looking at its genetic composition, it appears that it's likely to have originated in a bat. We don't know if there are intermediate steps along the way before it moved into humans.
And Hanta, does Hanta come from bats as well, or is that from...
No, Hanta, the Hanta virus is the majority of them, although there are Hanta viruses in virtually most mammals, really come from rodents, chiefly from mice.
So, but bats don't normally interact that much with people unless you go into caves, right, or into dark places. I mean, how does it transfer? And does it only take one interaction or a few from a bat to a human, and then it's sort of off to the races, as they say?
As you said, with MERS, it's a mystery, but there are a number of different infections that are probably well known to your listeners that are associated with bats or originated in bats. You mentioned SARS earlier, rabies, Nipah virus, Hendra virus, probably Ebola, but certainly Marburg. But again, there are frequently intermediate hosts along the way. So in some instances, these proved to be pigs, as they were originally with Nipah virus in Malaysia. Sometimes there's direct transmission from bats to humans, chiefly through excreta. So that's what has been observed in Bangladesh. Sometimes rabies is transmitted directly by bite. Rabies is a good example of that. So there are examples where bats have transmitted infections directly to humans. But we don't know the origin of MERS. We suppose that it's likely to be a bat based on genetic evidence, and we can't exclude the possibility that there are intermediates between bats and humans.
And you worked on the SARS outbreak in China. That was traced to civet cats, is that right?
Well, it's a misnomer. Civet cats are really more like ferrets.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, they were tracked back to civets. But the likely origin there, too, was bats, probably bats that were housed with civets and other small animals in wild animal markets. So as we increasingly encroach upon wildlife territory, we begin to see movement of infectious agents that have been hitherto restricted to those animals moving into human populations.
Now, for the benefit of our audience, what's a coronavirus?
It's there are many. Obviously, there are millions of different viruses. We tend to name them based upon their structure, what they look like under an electron microscope, or where they're originally discovered. So it's different than bacteria. In bacteriology, people like to name these bugs after themselves. Virologists don't do that. So it's called a coronavirus because under an electron microscope, it looks like a crown. It looks like a sphere with these little budding components that come off of it that really could do look. I mean, it's an apt name for it. It really does look like a corona around the virus. So, and that corona is basically comprised of fat and carbohydrate.
So some of these rare viruses, and you mentioned human encroachment into habitat, that's my understanding how Ebola infects humans, because it's largely dormant, I suppose. Also, to some extent, spores that cause Oh, God, I'm having a mental block here. What's the spores that cause...
Well, they're viral, you know, they're just viral particles. But typically what happens is that there will be a sentinel event. We'll have loss of great apes. Many of them have died as a result of exposure to Ebola or to Marburg. Sometimes you have people who go hunting for protein who wind up exposed to these to blood of these animals. That then allows them to become infected. And then as other people have intimate contact with them, by intimate contact I mean, you know, funerals or trying to take care of them in hospitals or clinics, they become infected, and that's the way it spreads. The most dangerous of these viruses, of course, are those that spread via respiratory route, because many people can become inadvertently infected. And we have a number of measures that we use to talk about how infectious an agent is. And the more infectious it is, the more people can be infected. Obviously, the more risk there is, assuming it's a fatal virus. Now, there are many viruses that don't cause fatal illness that spread quite easily, and we're not as worried about those. But in this instance, it turns out that MERS is not easily transmitted from person to person. We think we know why, and it's probably quite similar to what happened in SARS. You know, SARS was not stopped because we developed a vaccine or because we developed drugs. It was stopped because we developed good approaches to containment of the virus, isolating people who we thought were infected, developing diagnostic tests so we could identify who they were, and this allowed us then to stop the virus in its tracks. And I predict that the same thing is going to be the case here. The difference is MERS seems to be popping up in many different locations. But again, it's not spreading easily from person to person. And the only people who seem to have been infected have been people who had very close contact with individuals who have disease. And this is because the virus tends to infect the very, very deepest portions of the respiratory tract. It's not infecting the upper airways where it can be coughed up easily and transmitted to other people.
By the way, what I was trying to think of earlier was anthrax spores, or spores from anthrax. The encroachment, the idea that you have to really go to pretty remote places to stir stuff up, don't you, for it to come?
Well, actually, anthrax is not that hard to find. There are a number of nasty things which I'm not going to talk about because I don't want to give people ideas of what they should be going out and trying to harvest. But there are lots of infectious agents and components of infectious agents that are very that are found readily. But some of the ones I'm talking about, these exotic agents, if you want to use that, you know, some sort of term to describe them that describes how rare they are, like Ebola and Marburg, we wouldn't encounter these unless we went into places where they lurked. And there are other things there that we don't yet know about. I mean, something like 70% of the emerging infectious diseases that we're concerned about originate with animals. They are infections that are found typically in wildlife that move into either domestic animals and from there into people or directly into people. And there are a number of ways in which people are trying to pursue research to identify these agents before they move into the human population, become a risk, so we can readily detect them and respond to them with the appropriate drugs and vaccines. But as I said, with MERS, I think the key here is going to be containment. And we are trying, you know, we're doing it. We've developed a number of diagnostic tests that are now being used by a number of groups around the world every time there's an unexplained respiratory disease. And there are either probably half dozen labs now doing this sort of work around the world.
Well, so far, if the ratio of people infected to those who've died is 77 infected and 40 died, that's a pretty high ratio. It's almost
50%. It is a very high ratio, but that figure may be misleading because we don't really know how many people have been infected. All we know at present is the number of people who have been identified as being infected and those people who have died as a result of being infected. If you go back to 1999, when we first began to see, you know, West Nile virus appear in the Northeast, what occurred in that instance was everybody was concerned that there were many, many people who were dying of West Nile virus. But when we went back and looked using an antibody test of the number of people who've been exposed, we learned that only about 1%, not to say that this isn't important if you're in that unlucky 1%, but only about 1% of people who were exposed developed encephalitis, and an even smaller fraction of those died. So until we actually know how many people are exposed, we're not going to have a good handle on that. Now, I suspect, but this is only speculation, that we're not going to see a lot of asymptomatic disease. But again, I don't think there are many people who are going to be susceptible to it. Whenever you're dealing, however, with a new virus, and MERS certainly falls into that category, there's the opportunity for that virus to change, to become capable of transmission, to become capable of causing more severe disease, to spread in host range. So we have to keep a very close eye on it and how it develops, just as we did with SARS, just as we do with flu, just as we do with HIV, with all the infectious agents that worry us.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ian Lipkin, the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, who has over 30 years of experience in microbial discovery and outbreak response. He is now working with an international team of scientists to investigate a deadly new coronavirus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. Now, I mentioned earlier that the ratio of infected to died is 77 infected, 40 of whom have died. Compare that with SARS that you worked on in China. The outbreak in 2003 infected over 8,000 people and killed nearly 800, so considerably lower ratio. I take it what people are concerned about, since the outbreak appears to be largely in Saudi Arabia, is that in October, the annual Hajj, where millions of Muslim pilgrims from around the world come to Saudi Arabia, and that would, of course, be a vector to take this disease back all around the world if by then it's not contained.
This is indeed a risk, and I think you've identified the concern that's, that we have in the world community. But let me make a comparison to SARS, because I think that's illuminating. SARS, at least in certain locations, spread very easily from person to person. And there were these individuals we identified, we refer to them as super spreaders, who were capable of transmitting this virus readily to other people. We haven't identified anything similar with respect to MERS. Now, if that were to change, and that's, again, something that we need to watch and to be careful, you know, doesn't develop, the whole picture would change. But I was very much more worried about SARS than I am about MERS, simply because SARS really took off very dramatically in Beijing and in Toronto and in Singapore. And had it appeared in some other cities, we might have had the same sort of risk. And people became infected just walking through, you know, a specific lobby or a floor of a hotel. That's not occurred with MERS. The people who become infected as a result of exposure to other people have been individuals in a hospital sharing a room. And those individuals have been people who, you know, there's been typically something, you know, awry with them. They've had some underlying medical problem.
Well, my understanding is that a lot of the infections were in the dialysis unit and that
yes,
patients have been infected, and so have health workers. So how often does that happen?
So here's the big risk for health workers, and this is something that that was an issue during SARS as well. When you do what we call aggressive pulmonary toilet, which means you're using a lot of drugs that open airways, and you're using nebulizers that bring up mucus from deep in the lungs of an individual patient. The dose that you might be exposed to is much, much higher than if you're talking about just passing by somebody who's walking or sitting or lying down or what have you in some area. It's very different than what we saw in SARS. I certainly hope we don't get to SARS. That would be a tragic situation. And we are concerned about, you know, any sort of mass migration, any sort of mass gathering such as you talked about, like the Hajj. In the Hajj, you've got 3 million people, right, who are converging in certain holy sites. So it is a concern, but it's not just this year, and it's not just MERS. There's the same concern every year. And the WHO now has a center what's called a collaborating center for mass migrations that headed that's actually headed by the Deputy Minister of Health, Siad Memish, who's our partner in trying to work on this problem in Saudi Arabia.
Well, the New York Times describes this scene where a team of scientists from the Saudi Ministry of Health and Columbia University, I don't know whether you're among this team, that went to this Saudi village that was abandoned in the southwest. It's apparently had been abandoned for hundreds of years old. It was hundreds of years old and had been abandoned for a long time. And in the inky darkness, they found a small room that had become the roost of about 500 bats. And the scientists had to set up nets and catch them when they flew out at dusk to hunt for insects. It sort of sounds a bit like the beginning of a horror movie.
that was our team.
That was your team. So tell me about it.
What the team? Well, what we do is, because many of it, you know, unfortunately, this is not an area where we've had a lot of experience. So we have to work with, it's not to say a bad thing. We work with local people who know where the bats are found. It's interesting, in some cultures, you ask people, are there any bats? And they'll tell you no. And that's, in fact, what we were told when we initially went to Bisha in Saudi Arabia. But, you know, we have bats everywhere except Antarctica. And you can find them typically in caves or in abandoned buildings because they do like to nest in warm, dark places where they're safe from predators and large fluctuations in temperature. So the bats, and 70% of the bats in the world are insectivorous. The rest are fruit, majority really fruit eating. And based on the sequence analysis, of this MERS coronavirus and other coronaviruses that we and others have studied, it seemed most likely that the bat of interest would be insectivorous bats. What we then did was we went looking for them. And we found, as you say, these abandoned buildings. And what you do is you look for signs of bat guano, which is basically just, you know, bat feces. Because you may be looking there during the day and you may not see them because they're quite well hidden. And then you come back when they become active. There are a number of approaches. You use something called a harp net, which is basically a monofilament line. It looks like a harp, and the bats hit this monofilament line as they try to fly out of the cave, and they flutter down and they get captured in this little tarp where we sample them. And we don't kill bats. Bats are actually very useful animals. They keep insects under control. They're involved in pollination. So I don't want to give anybody the impression that we think the bats are evil. They're not. And then we release them. But in the meantime, we try to capture, we try to figure out whether or not they're infected with any virus that's important of interest. So the EcoHealth Alliance people, who really are the best at doing this is another group in New York who's our very close partners in these kinds of studies, are very good at doing these sorts of trapping and releasing studies. And we do work with them in Bangladesh and in South America, virtually all over the world. So, yes, it is sort of an eerie thing to be there at night and see all these animals fluttering around.
Well, you don't want to get bitten, though, do you? I mean, isn't that...
No, you don't want to get bitten. But, you know, you're primarily catching these insectivorous bats. These are tiny bats. Yes, you do not want to get bitten. But, you know, we're not going after vampire bats here. And the trick, really, with these microbats, these tiny bats, is not to hurt them. You know, that's clearly something we don't want to do. Now, the other approach we have is just not to sample the living animal at all, but just to collect the feces that the animal discards. So you just place a tarp in the area where you think they will be living, and you come back and you collect these fecal pellets. It's a little bit difficult in a very hot, arid climate, because if they dry out, you may lose your opportunity to recover what you want, which is really the virus nucleic acid, which is what you're going to characterize back in New York. And we people work under very difficult circumstances. I mean, it's very hot, and the gear which we use, because we don't want people inhaling any of these infectious organisms, which could be quite dangerous, are HEPA filtered. They use HEPA filtered air. They're covered, you know, from head to toe. And it's hot, and it's uncomfortable. So these people work under very difficult conditions. I only go there for a couple of days, and then I come back to New York and I focus on the lab part. You know, this is an ongoing process, and it's not just bats that we're surveying. We're actually going out and trying to collect materials from cats and hedgehogs and camels and so on.
Well, you're on the front line. That's obvious, Dr. Ian Lipkin, and that's the whole point, so that it doesn't cross to the wide population. So you've got your finger in the dike there, and it's very important work that you do, and we thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ian Lipkin, who is the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, who has over 30 years of experience in microbial discovery and outbreak response. In the 1980s, Dr. Lipkin identified AIDS-associated immunological abnormalities and was the first to use purely molecular methods to identify infectious agents, and implicated West Nile virus as the cause of the encephalitis epidemic in New York in 1999. He assisted the World Health Organization and the People's Republic of China during the 2003 SARS outbreak, and he and his team have discovered or characterized more than 500 infectious agents. He is now working with an international team of scientists to investigate a deadly new coronavirus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.